Okay. As I was saying, so I'll start talking about modular forms next time. I'm putting off one more time. And today I'll talk about how to use Perry, Magma, and Sage in more detail than I've talked about before. In particular, how to program them, how to write programs that are in separate files, how to do non-trivial programming with these systems. And after I do that, I'll talk about this paper that I'm currently working on, literally right now, with a couple of other people, which directly answers one of the questions that was asked last time, or at least addresses one of the questions that was asked last time, which you can read about in the paper. But I'll discuss this paper during the second part of today. Okay, so getting started, have any of you tried logging into Modular? I gave everybody a Modular account. So you have. Has anybody else?
I'm trying it again.
You? Has anybody tried and failed? Okay, so, and you don't need to. You always have the option to install the software on your computer. But, so three ways to run the three big programs that are relevant to this course, namely Sage, Magma, or Perry. Either you can log into Modular, and I gave everyone accounts. If your account doesn't work or I didn't give you one, then contact me. You can also just use this website, as I think you've all seen before. Just go to the website, you can type in a whole bunch of code, and then it gets fed once and for all to either Sage, Perry, or Magma, and then the output of that calculation, all the output, when you feed the code in, is printed out. So for example, this should print a whole bunch of numbers, for example. Let's see what happens. So scrolling down, it prints a bunch of 20th powers here. And you can do the same thing in Perry. Let's see, you get 1 to 10 pi to the 20. Oops, whoa, what have I done? One funny thing about Perry is that somehow the language is structured in such a way that if you start learning it, you'll find that you want to write everything as one line. It's extremely strange, but a lot of people, they write these Perry programs, and they're complicated, sophisticated programs, and they're one line long, but they're really, really, really long lines. It's just the way the language is. But you definitely don't have to do that. It's just that's what often happens. Okay, so that's the same program in Perry. And you might think, well, this is gone forever, and you'll never be able to remember what I just typed here. But at the bottom of this page, there's a log. So for example, you click view the Perry log, then you'll see the program that I just did. And I changed the log so that the last computation that somebody does is at the top. It used to be at the bottom. So now it's in reverse order. So even if the log is huge, you only have to download the beginning and then stop your web browser to see what people have been doing recently. And then let's see, in Magma, you would do the same calculation. You would say, for I in 1.10, do print I squared and 4, I think. Let's see if that's right. Yes, except I put 2 instead of 20.
And do you actually need the semicolons?
Yeah, I think you do. Magma is very.
Magma you do, but on your calculator.
In Sage, in Sage, you don't, never need semicolons. I think that in Magma you need them at least all except at the very end. So notice that it gave an error message.
Right.
So the one place where you could omit a semicolon here is the end 4. It'll stick a semicolon on at the very end, I think.
Okay.
But just so, because you might want to do something like 2+2 and have it work. So that's the one case where you don't need the semicolon is at the very end. But all the other semicolons have to be included. Okay, so Magma is pretty verbose compared to Perry and Sage in this particular example. So that's this is the second way to use it. And the third way to use Sage is to download and install it to your computer. How many of you have successfully done that? So two of you.
Only half as successful.
Well, what
it happened? Works fine, but what I still can't copy paste from the window.
Is it Windows?
Yeah.
Okay. It is possible to cut and paste from, it's a completely general Windows console issue. So the command.exe program in Windows, you can cut and paste from it, but the cut and paste works in a completely different way than it works in all the other Windows programs. And I don't know what the reason is. I think it was because the Windows programmers wanted to maintain some backward compatibility with any DOS program ever written. So they make the cut and paste very obfuscated. I would demonstrate it here right now, but I'm running Linux, not Windows. But basically, you select what, I think you have to, there's a little like button in the upper left corner of the window, and you can click there, and there's some menu, and you click something about starting the copy paste, then you select something, and you select something, maybe hit return, or select something else. It is possible.
It's mark, and then you can.
That's right, actually, mark, yeah. You can also go to the preferences for the window, and which is again somewhere in that menu in the upper left, and you can change the way cut and paste behavior works for command.exe, and it has it so that you can just highlight something and hit enter, and that's equivalent to copy, and then it's actually quite easy. But you have to select that; it's not the default. Okay.
Try that.
There are other ways that are a little bit better to deal with this problem. But they're kind of complicated. For example, not using Windows. No. Not using Windows, for example, is an excellent way.
That's my preference.
But actually, Cygwin, if you install Cygwin, then instead of using the command exe program, you can use rxvt or xterm, so the standard Unix/Linux terminals, and those support copy and paste much more naturally in a more normal Windows-like way. Okay. So that's what I wanted to say about installing, but I think I've said this sort of thing before. So now I'll say a bit about the basics of programming in Sage, Magma, and GPPerry. So actually, is anyone here going to actually use Perry for anything? You are, okay. I won't completely omit it, but I'll just say a few key things about it.
I'm only going to use Sage from here on out.
Well, you can just use, if you're using Sage, all you have to do is type, if you say GP of anything at all, for example, I equals 1 to 10 and I to the 20, it should just send it to Perry and then give you back the result. Put a print there. So, it's actually, what it's doing right here is it's really running Perry as a separate process and then communicating with the Perry process. So it's exactly equivalent to typing into Perry, except that you can have a whole bunch of them at once and stuff. Let's see. Back here. So I'll start with Sage. So before I talk about Sage, I'll say a little bit about Python, since Sage is essentially the Python programming language, but with a big library for mathematics. And so the first crucial thing to learn about Python is that white space is significant. So this is not the case in many programming languages. It is the case in LaTeX, for example, which you're used to, but it's not the case in most languages. But in Python, the following two things have completely different meanings. So if you're I'll use the, let's see, where do I want to do this? I guess this is a good place to do it. So for I in range 10, print hello. This is completely different than if you were to indent this. The meaning is completely different. What happens is, when you have a for loop in Python, everything that's indented is part of that for loop. There's no end for that you have to explicitly put. So this is not part of the for loop. So if we do this, it'll print the numbers up to 10 and the word hello, and that's it. It'll only print the hello once.
So what if you indent the bottom line like one space? I'm just curious.
There's one way to find out. Let's see, so unfortunately. Oh, there's one issue here. This is the online calculator, so it's actually feeding it into a running instance of Sage, so it works a little bit differently than if you were to write a program in a file and then load that program. So I have to put one space here. The answer to your question is it would be identical. It won't make any difference if you just indent at the beginning. That's something that I added to Sage, though. In Python, it would just give you a syntax error. It would be meaningful, I think. But we can try both of those. So just to be very clear, so running Sage, if you say for I in range, I mean, it's kind of clear when you're using it here because you hit an extra space and it gets you out of the loop and then it's over with. But if you had print hello inside of the loop, then you haven't hit that extra space that got you out of the loop.
Are you hitting return versus enter?
No, there's absolutely no difference at all between.
How do you tell it to actually?
You enter a blank line.
What's that?
You enter a blank line. That's how it knows that I'm getting out of it.
Okay.
Which is different than like maybe Mathematica or something, where you enter a bunch and then hit shift enter or something. It's just one blank line ends the loop. Okay. But that's something that's special to the interpreter that you actually type into. A crucial thing is that you can create little programs in files and then load those in. And what happens there is what you really want to know, because that's what you'll do most of the time. So here's an example. I'll call it example.sage. It doesn't matter how you end the file. You can call it .anything, but Sage is a good choice for a Sage program. So you can say for I in range 10 and I, and then print hello. Or actually, you can put I too. I will be the value after the loop terminated. So this is a little program called example.sage. And then I'll go over to this other. Well, for exposition, I'm going to run Sage inside of Emacs so that we can see both at the same time cleanly. But this will work in essentially the same way as if you run it from a shell prompt. So you can load that code, and it will execute it. Here what's going to happen is, because they're both indented, it's going to print I twice each time. So it's going to print the numbers, it'll print 11, 22, 23, and so on. Because they're indented, the extra space doesn't do anything when you're writing a program and then loading it in. It does do something, on the other hand, if you were directly typing into the interpreter. So if you were to put exactly this into the interpreter, that space would have got you out of the for loop, and then you would have typed an additional line. So notice that it printed the numbers each time. In contrast, if we get out of the for loop, so we have the for loop and then you have something completely different after it, then you can load that in and notice that it just prints out each number and then it prints the last value that I had going through the loop. Okay, so you had the question about indenting one, and it's a syntax error. So what happens is, it doesn't matter how much you indent, as long as you're consistent. And here you're inconsistent. Again, if you're just using the interpreter and typing in, it wouldn't matter. So for example, I can indent one here and say, print hello, that's no problem. That's the interpreter. The interpreter is one line at a time, and it strips off spaces from the left unless you're building up something with the dot, dot, dots. But when you're writing a program, what has to happen is that the indentation has to be consistent. So this is somehow meaningless. This is saying that that print is supposed to be part of some loop or the definition of a function, and there isn't anything there. So it's a problem because you're saying that the second print is in the same scope as the first, but you've indented them in a way that doesn't make sense. So you can indent, you can indent as long as you do it systematically. So if you go like that, and then like that, it's fine. You can indent any amount as long as you do that. And I think the indentation only has to be constant within a given loop. Let's see. So I think you can say indent like that for the next one, just maybe. Because it's there's no real ambiguity or question about what you mean here. So, but you can't have. You can't say indent this one at the bottom some funny amount. It confuses it because somehow there's no possible way that you could have it indented over that far and then indented back and still be part of the same loop. It just doesn't make any logical sense because you've by getting rid of the indentation there, you've got out of the loop, but then you're saying that you're inside of one. So just completely confusing, or is it clear? It's supposed to be like really simple. It's just you have the beginning of the thing, and then it's like a list. These are the things you're doing. And you indent it. Just very simple. And it's also much less cluttered than a lot of other languages. You don't have all these ends and semicolons and stuff everywhere. And if you really wish you had ends, you just put them there as comments. And I did this a lot when I was beginning Python. So if you have something really complicated, you could stick it there. Naki, sorry, I was ignoring you for a second.
I had a question.
Yes.
When you're loading example.sh, does it have to be located in a particular area?
It should be in the same directory that you started Sage in. So if you're using Cygwin, when you started, let's see. Well, if you install Cygwin and then you bring up a shell, and then you type the word sage and then it runs, it needs to be the case that the file that you're going to load is in the same directory as the directory where you type where you started Sage from. Okay, so that's important. So Cygwin, there's some directory that all the Cygwin files are in. And using Notepad, you can save files into that directory. You can edit files in that directory. And you can find that directory using Windows Explorer. I think it's typically /Cygwin/users/your username. Yes?
So it's not good that it's just in our path?
No. It doesn't just, when you say load, it doesn't search everywhere in the whole computer for that file. It searches only in the current directory. I don't know if I've written it in such a way that you can give a complicated path for the load. I don't think that's the case, though. Yes?
What about if you run it on like SSH, like Putty or something like that?
Uh-huh. If you're running over SSH, that means you're running it on modular, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then on modular, you have a home directory. And in that home directory, you have to place this file.
Okay.
So for example, you could edit it in your favorite editor under Windows and just copy it over using SFT, well, whatever the FTP.
You can FTP there.
Yeah, you just use an FTP call and copy it over. So you make a big program, copy it over, and then load it. Now, the annoying thing about load is that basically what it does is it just goes through and it runs everything in your file. You might want to define a function, so let's make a function. In Python, the way you make a function is you give it a name, such as, it's really silly, but you give it a name and then you just indent everything, like that, normalizing the indentation. So I just defined a function called foo, and all you say is def space the name of the function, the arguments of the function, colon, and then indented one level, typically, the number of spaces so that this sort of matches up, you just put the entire definition of the function. And you can put pretty much anything in there. And if you want the function to return a value, for example, maybe we'll have this one return the last value that I took on, then you just put return at some point in the function. Okay? So now we can again load this, and it'll do the second loop right there. But it didn't do anything with the first thing. It just defined that function. That's a function that we now have access to, and that we can now run. And then it gives us the output. So
there's no types you need when you pass in the function?
No. If you want to do... So everything in Sage/Python has a well-defined type, in the sense that... Not really well... at any instant, a variable has a type. The type of a given variable can change. For example, let's let n be the string like that. At this moment, the type of n is a string. However, you could also let n be a number like that, and now the type of n is an integer. So it's not like in C++ or Java or certain other languages where a variable name, once you have to say what type it'll hold, and then it can only hold that type. Also, every single variable is essentially a reference in Python. So this can cause you some trouble if you don't know about it. So let's make a list of length 5. And let's define a function that it takes as input a list. I'll just call it F2. And what it does is, let's say it changes the first entry of the list and then prints out the result. This is going to change the list that we pass in. So again, we have to reload the code using the load command. And now we have a function f2, and we can pass it in n. It's going to print out this with the first entry changed. But now look at our n. Our n itself was changed. So all these lists, you should think of them as pointers to the list. Everything's by reference.
Even if you just have an integer, it's by reference.
Well, there you can't change. Integers are not changeable in any way. So it is by reference, therefore faster. And if your integer had 1,000 digits, it just passes a pointer to that. But you can't actually change digits of an integer. If you assign to the integer, if you assign to the name of the variable that holds the integer, you don't change the original variable because it's, I'll just illustrate. So if you make a function here, 3, it takes an integer as, we'll think of it as an integer. You set it equal to 5. This isn't going to change what you pass in to be 5. It's only that the n initially when you passed it in, that was a pointer to this. But what happens here is that 5 right there, that literal, that is itself an integer. And when you say n equals 5, then in this scope, the variable n is now a pointer to this new integer, to 5. The old integer that was in n when you called the function, that it's just, it's not affected in any way. So I'll illustrate that. So if you say, n equals 7, then you say f3 of n. What it's going to do is it's going to print out 7. That's what n will be when that print statement is hit. But then it's going to change this variable n to be 5. But it's not going to change this n, since this is a completely different n. See, n is still 7 down here, even though I assigned n to be 5 up there, because they're different n's. So there's there are two things here. There's the 5 and the 7. There's the n in this scope that points to the 7, and when you call this function, there's that n right there that at first points to the 7, but when you say n equals 5, it now points to the 5. But this n is still pointing to the 7. Yes?
So I'm confused now. It seemed like when you did the F2 program,
yes,
you actually changed V2.
That's right. No, I didn't change the V that was in here, but I changed, let's see, how does it is?
So when you
I changed what V pointed to right here.
Mm-hmm.
There's V at this point points to a list of numbers, and I changed one of those numbers. But I didn't actually change,
I was going to say, so when you use the square brackets, you're dereferencing the pointer.
Yeah, you could think of it that way.
Oh, so if we had said F3 of 7, then it would change then, but since we've already, so with programs, everything's considered local?
Yes, everything's local, yeah. Okay. Well, except for variables that are global to the scope of the file, which you can use.
Or if it returns it, does it become global?
No, it's just that it's returning. Not really global, but there's
few global variables. So if a variable hasn't been assigned yet, and your program uses it, then mm-hmm. it'll point to that variable. But if it's already been assigned before the program hit, it won't change it globally.
It could or couldn't. It may or may not. But let's see. I think probably a better way to, the scope of this file is different than the scope of this session right here. So maybe that, or at least a little bit different. Let me think about that for a second. So right here, this N has sort of nothing to do with the N down here, but maybe I should call it M because there's confusion resulting from calling it N. So I say F3 of n doesn't change n, and there's no m defined at all. So the m here is something local to that function.
Okay.
So you could make an m that was sort of global to this file, and I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. So m is now defined. Say when this we call this. So it should change m. This should change m to be. Well, no, you think this would change n, but actually it won't, because this m is local to the function because I declared it as an argument right here. But there is a way to change that m if you really wanted to. So you could call this x, for example. And then here what you could say is global m, and then m equals 5. And now the m right here now will be the one that's global.
Okay.
So you can say, I want to access the global. If you didn't put the global there, though, it would just create a new local m local to the scope of that function. That's the default. So now watch what happens. Now m has changed to 5. But if I didn't put that global there, I'm pretty sure that it would not change the value of m. It's kind of annoying that it keeps running this little piece of code. I'll just delete this. Oops, deleted one too many lines. Okay, so now m is 0, but then I should call this function, it should still be 0. Yes. So by default, any variable you use in the definition of a function is local. So you can't accidentally screw up and use n when you're using it somewhere else and wipe it out. However, if you really do know what you're doing and want to use one that's at a global scope, say for your session, use the global keyword. So you'd say global of n. Okay? So that's how it's designed in Python. So that's how you define a function. You can give any number of arguments. So let me give another one. Def, say add x and y. And then you can return x plus y. So that's two arguments. Oh, by the way, instead of using load, there's another handy command called attach, which it works exactly like load the first time you use it. But then what it does is each time you enter a blank line, it checks to see if any of the attached files have changed. And if they have, it reloads them. So you don't have to constantly reload. So for example, if I decide to make this return a sort of incorrect answer, I go down here. If I immediately use the function, unfortunately, it doesn't reload the file. But if I enter one blank line, then it reloads the file and tells you that it's reloading. It would actually reload the file without the blank line if I could figure out how to do that. But I haven't figured out how to do that yet. I wrote the attach command, but I don't know how to make it work without sort of a blank line there. On the other hand, maybe it's good to have a blank, you know, have to explicitly ask it to reload by giving a blank line. Now add will have different behavior. It'll return 30. So. Okay, so that's how you define functions, and you saw for loops a minute ago. The notations is, essentially, it's as simple as you can possibly imagine. Any extraneous notation at all, such as brackets, curly braces, ends and begins, semicolons, it's all gone. Just the minimum you need. The way comments work is as follows. So you just put a hash and then everything after it's a comment, just like shell scripts or various other languages. There's really no notion of multi-line comment where the comment is something that isn't seen by the program at all. But there's a good analog of that, namely doc strings. So whenever you define a function, the typical thing you do is right after the function, you give in triple quotes a description of the function. Together x and y. So this can span as many lines as you want. You can have basically anything in it. If you want to have absolutely anything in it, if you put an r here, it's a raw string. You can literally put anything, like backslashes, whatever, and it won't change it.
Does it have to go at the beginning of the function, or can you do that anywhere?
You can put this anywhere. It's a valid Python statement. You could stick it, if you wanted to have, you know, like a huge discussion about what your, you know, what this file does, so, which is a good thing to do, like right at the beginning. You could just stick in double quotes right at the beginning, you know, this file is an example of blah, blah, blah. And you can just go on and on, like, about that, so. Actually, I'm a little, not quite sure what it's going to do, so, yeah. You can put that anywhere. Also, if you define documentation for a function and then say the function's name with a question mark, then it gives you that documentation back, which is nice. Also, another nice thing you've probably already seen is that if you give two question marks, it gives you the... not interesting. It doesn't work. Well, it's not clear it should work in this instance, but I see. So there are two ways, really, to define code that you can use inside of Sage. One is by writing these files that are exact Sage code. This is just anything you can type into Sage. There's also a completely different way, which is the following. You write Python programs, and then you import them into Sage, just like you would in the Python interpreter. And that has fuller support for the source code. So this just shows a piece of the source code. But if you use that mechanism, then you get the full source code. Actually, what happens when you attach this file or load it, it converts it into a Python program, as indicated here. And then that Python program is then loaded. And I can do this. Well, it's not. I have to think about this. I'm having random ideas about ways to make this whole system better, but I shouldn't start thinking about them right now. So in any case, it's slightly different than the original Sage code. Here's a way in which it's different. In Sage, if you do the following, so back to our original file, let's have a function called g of, just g. And what it does is it returns 5/4. Okay, so it reloads it, and then we can call it, and we get back the rational number 5/4. In Python, what that would do is return 1, because it would return the integer 1, because in Python, it works just like in C. 5 and 4 are these integers, and it just returns the integer 1, which is the floor of 5/4. So let's create exactly the same code, but in Python, just for illustration. Now I can import that. Now I have that one function defined, and then I can call it, and it returns the integer 1. Type of the previous thing is int. So you can write arbitrary Python code in addition to Sage code, and then you import it. That's the command you use. There's some advantages to that and disadvantages. But for everything you do in this class, make sure you find to just, you write a file like this in Sage, where everything works exactly like it's documented in Sage, and then you attach it or load it. Yes?
It probably isn't that important, but why would you want to ever import? Why would you ever want to write separate Python code?
Well, all the Sage is written.
In Sage, I could see there's already some Python written, but would you ever want to write something outside of Sage and then bring it into Sage?
Yeah, most everything I write is that way. So, yeah. The reason is just that this file imports the entire Sage. What are the issues? One is that the Python language does a lot of annoying things. For example, the caret symbol in Python is exclusive OR and has the wrong precedence to be exponentiation. So if you type, for example, 2 arrow 3, if you type that in Sage, you get 8. But if you type the same thing in Python, so I'll illustrate that. I'll put in a different file. In a different function. You'll get a completely different answer. So this is probably a non-example of what you're asking about, but we have to reload it, sorry. Because it's a Python thing that we're still doing. Okay, so notice that it gives you 1, which is completely different. So Python has a little annoying things like that. So that's an argument for not writing things in there. But the problem is Sage is written in Python, so you have to write in Python and tell you. At some point, enough of Sage will be written that you can primarily write things using Sage. But you run into serious circular dependencies, basically. That's really the problem. When you write a .sage file, it imports all the Python stuff that I've written for Sage. And if you try to write Sage in an environment in which all of Sage is imported, you run into a contradiction when you're trying to write in an environment that's already imported itself. So that's one reason. In Sage code, you have to be very explicit about which code from other packages are being used in your program in order to implement your program, in order to implement your little piece of Sage. Otherwise, you have all kinds of circular dependencies that can't be resolved by the interpreter. So if you're writing something that will be part of Sage and included with Sage,
Some sort of mathematical operation, why would you want to?
You wouldn't. I don't think you would. I don't think you would. Unless, well, there's a ton of Python code out there, and it's written in plain Python. And for example, it would assume that a caret is exclusive OR. So if you wanted to use any Python code you copied off the internet for Python, then you would want to import it, since it might not work correctly in Sage, or it might have a different meaning in Sage. So Sage actually parses the input and changes it slightly in some cases. Yeah, and you can see what it does. If you look at, you take your file, and then once you've loaded it, if you append.py, that's the Python version of it. And it does a little bit. Namely, it wraps certain integer literals in ZZ, which makes Sage integers, which are integers that are implemented by me using GMP. It also changes the meaning of exponentiation a little bit. So for example, if we were to, here's an example right here. Notice that there's a star star there instead of a caret. In the other file, there was a caret. In Python, you have to use star star. So that's what it's there.
And do something with H?
Well, H doesn't, let's see. So this H is, the H that I gave was just a part of a Python program, so there's no parsing that goes on. Okay, let's see, what else do you need to know? I told you almost everything. Let's see, so load, attach, import, documentation. Anytime you want to do something with an object, you create some instance of the object, for example, elliptic curve. I think I've already told you this, though, and then you say, but I'll tell you again. So you make an elliptic curve, and there are some subtle points, though, that I should emphasize. One, if you want lots and lots and lots of information about the elliptic curve, you just say help of the elliptic curve, and it gives you this massive, thousand lines description of every single function that you can call in the elliptic curve. So it's all there, lots and lots of documentation. If you use this from the interpreter, if you don't use it in Emacs, it at least puts it in a pager so that you can page through and search and so on. You can also say E dot, that doesn't work in here because I'm in Emacs. But
yeah, other weird things that happen here in Emacs?
Well, there's two ways to run Sage in Emacs. And there are a couple of subtle differences in how it works. I think there's a way to do tab completion, but I don't use it in Emacs very much. I'm only using it for right now because I think it's better for illustrating this. Normally, I don't use it in Emacs. In Emacs, if you just start up Emacs, you can say alt-x term, and then it just runs exactly like a normal terminal, basically. There's really no difference at all. But on the other hand, you basically lose all the advantage of using Emacs if you do that. It really does just run like a normal terminal. But,
Well, you can like split windows.
Yeah, maybe it's a little nicer. So you can do tab completion. But the functions that you get depend on more than it just being an elliptic curve. If you make this same elliptic curve over the finite field GF7, the finite field of order 7, the functions you get are actually, it's a much smaller list of functions. So it depends on more than just the function that you use to build the thing. This elliptic curve, it's a type, well, it's really on type at the end, it's elliptic curve finite field, right here. And the other elliptic curve I made before was an elliptic curve over the rational numbers. And they're related, they both derive from some common base type, but they're actually different, so they have different functions.
Can you get a list of the different objects? Like, suppose you didn't know it was called elliptic curve.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do?
You would look, well, first you would try LL and hope with tab. You could just hit tab by itself and you'll get 635 things. So these are all the functions that you can just use. You could also go to the web page, the documentation for Sage. Notice at the top of the calculator, there are links to documentation for all three systems. So in particular, one of them is Sage. And if you click here, there are four pieces of documentation. A programming guide hasn't been written yet, though I keep meaning to do it every day. The tutorial I just recently greatly revised and improved, but it doesn't really tell you that much. It's just a quick tour. And the manual, that really gives you a lot of information. So here you can page through here and say you're interested in elliptic curves, so you could, there are a couple of things. You could just do a text search in the table of contents of the manual and you would find it. So you could do that. You can also look in the module index. This is a list of all the different code modules that are part of Sage, and one of them is, let's see, schemes, hypersurfaces, plane curve, elliptic, rational field. So you could click there. There's also just a full text index search. So you could search through here. It's very large, and you could find elliptic curve, and this tells you how to make them and so on. So you can click here, and then you can start browsing around and learning about elliptic curve objects. And so you get a list of the functions on a generic elliptic curve, and a bunch of examples illustrating how to use each of the functions. And these are all tested to make sure they work correctly, automatically. So this is really the primary place at present to look is in the reference manual right here. Okay, so that's Sage. Any questions before I move on to Magma? Okay. Oh, one other thing I want to point out is that Sage, of course, is not even close to being done, unfortunately, but wrong thing. There is a page I just made a few days ago which has a list of projects that need to be done in Sage, ordered by priority and category and so on. You can reorder them in different ways, say by category. So if you're interested in helping me, you can look at this list and see if anything appeals to you.
Five is the most,
I presume. Yeah, the dark red high number. Highest priority, yeah. So I really, really, really need to implement polynomial factorization over GFP to the E. Or that's actually probably not too hard to implement. Whenever possible, I try to just have it call another system like Perry. Okay, so that's Perry. Now let's move on to Magma. Let's see, I think I'll just try to answer the same questions that I just answered, but for Magma. So how do you create a file, put Magma code in it, and then run it? That's the question. So sample.sage, so we had that. So let's do something similar in Magma. So I'm going to make a file, and I'm going to load it into Magma. And it's going to contain functions. So I'll call it example.m for Magma. A lot of people write .mag for Magma because .m is like, used by some other programming languages. But the Magma people all write .m. And the Magma code that comes with Magma ends in .m. OK, so there are two things to know here. First, you can just write code that would normally be, that's essentially the same as what you would type into the interpreter. And that's pretty straightforward. You so you say there are two things. There are functions like so function f1, it takes two things, and then I don't know, print hello, and then return n plus m in function. So it's a little more verbose than in Sage, but I think that's correct. Okay. This will work. So you just say load, and then you give the file name, exactly like in Sage. Actually, Sage is exactly like this rather than the other way around. Then you can call the function, and it returns something. Functions have to return something. And generally speaking, they're not supposed to change anything else global. They're supposed to be self-contained in Magma. So it's a syntax error, I think, if the function doesn't return anything, or at least at some point it was. I don't know what the current status is. I think functions have to, I think it's an error if the function doesn't return something. So error, no return statement. So it's actually an error to not return. In Python, what would happen is that none would be returned. None is a special value, and that's the default return value for any function. So in Magma, if you want to define something that doesn't return anything, you call it a procedure. And then, if it returns something, I better call it a different name, so G1. If it returns something, that's a syntax error. So, see, it's a syntax error just in loading the file. I can't even load it because it returns something. So in Magma, you're not allowed to return anything if you're defining a procedure. So let's see. So you define functions and procedures with function and function. Everything ends in semicolons, for loops and so on. It's all sort of things that you look up. But for I in, the way you make a list of integers is you say, maybe do that. So you say the first integer in the list, and then dot dot, and then the last integer. So that will print out all these integers. There's so it'll print 2 and 3, and then hello. Or hello, and then, oh, sorry, call G instead of F. Okay, so hello, and then 2, 3, and 5. So that's one thing you do in Magma is you can load files, but you have to reload them over and over again. There's also one other thing which people very, very rarely use because it isn't well documented. So the people that write non-trivial code for Magma use this all the time, but people who just read like Magma tutorials and you know sort of learn something about Magma almost never know about it. And that's you can attach files, and in the attached files, the only thing that the user sees, well, you don't see any of the functions or procedures in the file that you attach, but you see intrinsics, which are like functions or procedures, but you have to explicitly declare the types of each of the input arguments. and the notation's a little different. For example, it's a syntax error if you don't correctly comment your intrinsic. So here's how that works. So I'll call this example2.m, and I'll make an intrinsic. So you have to say intrinsic, and then give it a name like t. I'll call it t, and then it takes, say, two input arguments. And you have to give the types, and then you say what it returns. It's kind of complicated. Then you have to give a mandatory comment. I'll leave out the comment, and you see that's a syntax error. This will return n plus m. Okay, and now the way it works is you attach it, but in capital letters. I mean, the attach is capitalized. Oops, it's actually this example two. Sorry. What's wrong? Oh, it's a syntax error. I didn't comment like that. So you have to put a comment. This intrinsic returns n plus m. You have to put a comment in braces, even though in Magna comments are usually in, like in C or plus, but in this one case they're in braces. You have to put a comment, and then it will work. And now attached it, and now you can say t of 5, 6. But this attached code is really cool. So one thing is that if you define a function here, it's just local to the file, and you don't see it even when you attach. So for example, if I define a function k of n that, say, returns n plus 1, n function, even if I attach this file again, say, I won't see that k. It simply isn't defined. All the functions are local. The only thing that you're exporting when you do this attach is the intrinsics. Also, one really cool thing is that if you change the intrinsic and then call it again, change any code actually in an attached file and then call it again, it'll every time Magma executes another line, it looks to see if any of the things that are attached have changed. And if even one of them has changed, it reloads it. So attached means loaded. And a huge chunk of Magma is written using these attached files with intrinsics. So really, I almost always use, in all cases, I think intrinsics are better than using load. The only thing is the annoying type checking. But first, there are two things. One, the return type checking is a complete lie. It doesn't actually check that the return type satisfies that condition. You can return absolutely anything you want. For example, there are returned a rational number, which is not an integer. So the only thing that really happens is that it checks that something is returned at all. If you don't put this little arrow and then something being returned, then it'll say that it's an error because you said nothing to be returned. The other trick is that you can just get rid of the type checking by putting a dot there. And then that means accept any type at all. Oh, by the way, let me show you what happens if you give, say, a rational number as input, it gives you an error message, the wrong type. But you can just put a dot here. The reason that the type checking is important really is because it allows you to have a whole bunch of different functions with the same name. And which one is called depends on the types of the arguments. That's really how it's used in Magma. But you, as a user, don't have to worry about that. You can just declare your intrinsics like this, and you have a nice feature that once you attach a file, you can sort of have it automatically attach a bunch of things when you start up. All you have to do is change the code, and it's automatically changed inside of Magma, which is very nice. Yes?
So I'm just trying to make sure I understand the lesson.
Yes.
You can have an intrinsic T,
yeah,
which sends ring integers and M, and plus M.
Yeah.
And then you can have intrinsic T, which is if they're rational numbers,
that's right,
multiplies them together.
Let's try it. And you might wonder, how in the heck do you figure out what the types are? Because these things look pretty funny and so on. All you do is you make something of the appropriate type, and you say type of that. It's actually capital N. Another thing is in Magma, everything that's capital is lowercase in Sage and vice versa. Like true and false are lowercase in Magma and uppercase in Sage. And type is lowercase in Python and uppercase in Magma. So it's kind of annoying. It's field rat L. So now we can say T of 2, 3, and that will... Oh, I forgot to make it different. 2, 2, 3, that will give you 5. And T of the rational number, 2... Oh, wait, they both have to be rational. Otherwise, it's a syntax error. That gives you 6. So it's neat, it works, but it's... Well, it just means that it's very important to declare the types if you're going to have multiple functions of the same name. And one reason this is really important is because in Magma, every intrinsic, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of them, they all have the same scope. They all sit together in the same scope, in the global scope of the interpreter. And when you call, for example, the function order on something, there are maybe 100 different versions of that function, and which one it calls depends on the type of the thing you call it on. So if you say order semicolon, it'll show you all functions that are named order all over the code. So this is all over Magma. And see each of these headings? These are the different types. So if you call order with a group abelian gen elt, a ring elt, and a ring elt, then it calls that one, and so on. So there are tons and tons and tons of different definitions of the word order. So because there's no notion of, you know, this T, once you attach example two, this T has exactly the same sort of, it's not in any way in a different scope than anything that's defined as part of Magma that, you know, when you download Magma initially. It's just as much of a player in the game as any code that is included with Magma. Okay, so is there anything else to say about Magma? Let me see. So you load attach and documentation. There's a ton of documentation at the Magma website, which you can get to, I think, by just in the calculator. If you click on documentation for Magma, you get it. So here it is. So how to use the documentation? Well, there's various books with big examples and so on, but basically the way I use the documentation is there's something I want to work with, and I try to find it in the index, and then I kind of track it down from the index. This used to work really well when the index made sense. Unfortunately, they changed the index, so when you click on a letter, you just get this little range. And it used to be that you could just do like a full text search in this page and get everything, but now you can't, because you have to kind of keep clicking down to get to the actual words. So it's pretty annoying. It's very hard to use. I don't like it. So sometimes you have to just try to dig through here and figure out where what you're interested in is defined. But mainly this is the thing to look at, this document, called the reference manual also, I think. Or just the, what is this called? It's called the handbook, sorry. So in Magma it's called the handbook. But this is really the source of the important documentation for Magma. And the reason you use Magma primarily is because it implements, I mean, if you're going to use Magma, the reason you'll be using it is because it happens to implement a huge amount of different things that are relevant, at least in number theory and in group theory. So, and it does it very quickly. You can do quite a lot in here. So if you start clicking around, you'll discover that. There's a lot of functionality here. So the various chapters of this handbook are written by all kinds of different people, and then you can find out here if you click on this acknowledgement link. For example, you can search me and find that I read some things. Okay, so let's see what else. That's it. So now Perry. Let's see. Well, okay, the main thing, there are really, I guess, two things to know about Perry. One, you can write Perry scripts, which are just like what you would type into the interpreter again. And so, there's Perry. You read them in by saying backslash r, and then you give the name of the file. Or you say read, and then it quotes the name of the file. An annoying thing about Perry is it starts up with a certain amount of memory, and as soon as you exceed that, it kills your computation dies, and you get an error message. And it's very easy to have that happen. Look, I ran out of memory, computing 2 to the power. So what you do is you can start up Perry with a flag S, and then you give it some big number, and it'll try to allocate a huge amount of memory. So now I allocated as much, you know, this is sort of big chunk of memory. So now when if I do what I did before, it probably won't die unless the number really was ridiculous. It's going to. It does a funny thing, which is it prints out the line unless it prints out the result of the value of the previous line unless you put a semicolon at the end to suppress that. So in this case, it was probably spending all its time converting that to a decimal string and printing it.
So the prime limit stays at
what?
500,000.
Sorry, what?
So when you prime limit, that's the biggest.
Yeah. Prime. It makes a table of primes when it starts up using a sieve, you can adjust what it uses. Like how far it goes, it might take longer to start up, but or use more memory if you use a larger value. See how there's a noticeable pause? Right now it's computing a table of primes. And for some applications it turns out to be useful to have a large table of primes pre-computed. And if you know that you're going to write a program that does that, then you'll want to set that prime limit large when you start up. Let's see. So some reasons to use Perry. First, the entire source code package is like 1.5 megabytes. And you can download it, you can install it in, you can compile it on almost anything with the C compiler. It doesn't require any assembler support for a specific architecture, even though it has that in many cases. It's very, very fast at what it does for the most part, except for linear algebra, it's not so good. But number fields and, well, I'll just give you a little tour of the documentation. So number field type stuff is extremely broad. In fact, the system was, to some extent, written to test out all the algorithms in Omri Cohen's books. So it has implementations of many of those algorithms. And he's written sort of the books on algorithmic number theory. It's really good support for polynomials, power series. It has a lot of transcendental functions. It also has extremely, surprisingly good numerical integration for, and you wouldn't expect that from this, but in fact, apparently in number theory, I haven't run into it so much myself, but often numerical integration of certain functions turns out to be very helpful. And, oops, the question mark at the end. Wait, it's into num. What is it? Into num. Oh, wait, question mark at the end. Yeah, there's the document. Wow, that's long. That's quite a page full, isn't it? So, fortunately, I think you can, if you do double question mark, it tries to run. Oh, it didn't work here, but when correctly installed, it will run XDVI and show you the appropriate page of the documentation. So the main advantage of Perry is that it's extremely small. It's all open source. It doesn't depend on any. It doesn't really depend on anything else except readline. It uses GMP for speed, if you have it. So it's very small. You can read. You can sort it with the source code. It's actually pretty obfuscated and miserable to look at, but sometimes it's nice. Wait, comments? Oh, GMP, I'm sorry. Yeah, the new multi-precision library. It's a library for arbitrary precision integer arithmetic. And as you might imagine, there's a vast theory of how you multiply two numbers together quickly. And some people have spent a lot of time trying to optimize this, and fortunately they've done it in such a way that it's available to other people to use. Everybody uses GMP now pretty much. Even Magma uses GMP. GMP's, the license is GPL and LGPL, meaning that you can use it in closed source programs as well. Okay, so for the most part, the function help is pretty short, but anyways, it's a fairly simple system. The main complaint that I hear from students about Perry is that the output is extremely unpleasant to look at. For example, compare this. With the same thing in Perry. And it's really not so bad for elliptic curves, but this is how Perry prints an elliptic curve. Yeah, this is how Sage and Magma both print an elliptic curve, and that's how Perry does. And this is somehow a little more difficult for your random user to get their head around. So the idea in Perry is that essentially anything that gets printed, an object prints itself in such a way that you can just paste it right back in and that completely recreates the object. Also, the type of an elliptic curve is a vector. It's just a vector of numbers, or possibly vectors in some cases here. If you have a program that will produce a vector like that, then that can serve as an elliptic curve for all the elliptic curve functions. So it's very, very flexible in some ways. There's only like maybe 10 or 15 different types in Perry. Vector, integer, fraction, and so on. And then they sort of serve to encompass the other types. So it's kind of painful to look at the output of Perry stuff. That's probably the biggest problem with Perry, actually. It has an actively supported development. A lot of people write code for it, and it's regularly updated, but it's awful to look at. And for number fields, it's even worse. So, make the number field defined by x to the fifth plus x plus 1. So in Sage or Magma, they'll print out like that number field defined by that polynomial. And in Perry, well, that wasn't a good example. Usable. Okay, this is how it prints out the number field. So, isn't that great?
Yeah. Oh, that's
awesome. Yeah, what do you, so, certain people prefer this, but those people are few and far between. And I think it's a serious problem, so.
Can I suppress the output?
Yes, you can. But, so, I mean, there. That's nice, but on the other hand, you still might have K sitting around and you want to, you know, you want to see it, and you get that massive page of junk that you don't understand. The one good thing is there are a few functions you can access like that, which help. Or what ends up happening is you memorize, like, you know, the third component has some special meaning, or, you know, the fifth component has some special meaning. So you could probably ask, like, Neil Melkies or Don Zagier what the 17th component of the number field vector is, and they'll tell you. So, yeah, so the output of Perry is really pretty nasty.
So but, that whole thing that whole thing is just some way it's stored in the number field that it can use to compute. I mean,
that's right. There's a bunch of internal information it computes about the number field when you create it, and that information is stored here. And you can see what is actually stored in this list.
You don't need all that.
You don't need all that to define
it. Yeah. So what it computes is, for example, the I think it's computing quite a bit here. I mean, it's computing an integral basis for the ring of integers. It's computing a lot when you say n infinite. I think you can give a flag to have it compute less.
And Sage won't then compute all that stuff right off the hand. It'll just say, you want this, and as you ask for the stuff, it'll compute.
More or less, yeah. Sage uses Perry. Sage doesn't do very much with number fields yet.
Is there some place where they've written that algorithm? Or should you just look at that?
Henri Cohen's books are really the main place to look up the algorithms that are implemented in Perry. What?
I don't know how they find integral bases.
It's not that fast. But the difficulty is integer factorization. That's really the problem. If you could factor integers quickly, you could find bases, integral bases quickly. That's equivalent to that. That's the stumbling block. The reason is you quickly get z adjoint the root of the polynomial, and then you have to get up to the ring of integers. And enlarging this is pretty straightforward. There's a complicated but very fast algorithm that essentially just involves linear algebra modulo primes, which is, I think, due to Hendrik Venstra. I, in fact, saw him reinvent it once in front of my eyes on the bus. But it goes from here to here. But the problem is you have to know what primes divide this index in order to sort of enlarge at those primes. And to get from here to here, so there's a discriminant. Here it's the discriminant of this order is the discriminant of the polynomial which defines the number field. This has a discriminant also. And this discriminant is a perfect square times that discriminant. So that's the way the discriminant changes. When you look at a smaller subring or order, the discriminant goes up by the square of the index. And so what you do is you take this discriminant, and then you have to find the primes whose square divides it. But that requires factoring this, as far as we know. We don't know how to define, you know, the squares that divide something. It'd be nice if you take your integer and take its derivative and take the GCD. But that doesn't make any sense, unfortunately. And that's what you do with a polynomial. If you wanted to find the square factors of a polynomial, it's easy. Take the GCD as a derivative. But an integer is, as far as we know, as difficult as factoring to find the square factors. So that's the bottleneck, ironically. It seems like the algorithms to factor are complicated, but that's the bottleneck. Although linear algebra looks very complicated, it actually is fast compared to the factoring step. So here, if I say integral basis, it has not computed the integral basis yet. But when I asked for this, it then what happened secretly was it called Perry, it made this number field in Perry, and then extracted out the integral basis and put it back in a Sage format. And so far, there's really not very much that's been sort of wrapped in this way. These are the functions that are available. I'd like to have essentially all of the Perry functionality available from within Sage in this clean way where the output looks really nice. And anyone here who is interested in helping me, please do, because this is yet another project that was listed on that web page. And keep not doing it, so. It's the sort of thing that, like,
it's assigned different parts of it as our examination.
What? Sorry, I'm not hearing
that. Just assigned different parts of it for our examination.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it takes a little time to figure out how to, you know, to understand how to do this. So I can show you what you have to do. If you look at integral basis, there's the documentation. If you put two question marks, you see the source code. And this is a Python file. And you know, you have to learn a little bit. This is it. These four lines right here do really all the work to create the Perry object to, well, not. There's a method of the number field to get the corresponding Perry. Actually, here what it's doing is it's taking the number field, getting the polynomial, it defines it as a Perry polynomial. Then there's an NF basis command that you can call on a polynomial in Perry without creating, you know, that could be everything about the number field. And then you take that polynomial and turn it into a Sage polynomial. Actually, I guess you take the output of NF basis and turn that into a list of Sage polynomials, which are then really elements of the number field. But it's these four lines that do the functionality of computing the integral basis. So it's very simple from the point of view of Sage. All the work, of course, is really inside of NF basis, which is implemented in C as part of Perry. And is a probably extremely complicated function, which I've never looked at. Okay, so that's pretty much it for Perry. I guess one other thing to know about, I mentioned earlier that you often end up writing functions that are one line long, because this is the way you make a function in Perry. So you just, it's very functional. It's very mathematical. You just say the function's name, the arguments, equals, and then what it does. And a list of things, and the last thing in the list is what gets returned. So for example, you could say I equals 5, print hello, and then the last thing is n plus m. So it'll do all that other stuff, but then the thing it returns is the last thing in the list. So it definitely encourages one-lineness because of how it's listed there. Also, there's... Well, okay, so there are two things. First, if you put an open bracket before this, then you can span multiple lines. So, put the equal sign in. It just takes, essentially just strips out all the spaces, except the ones in quotes. This is identical to the previous function. It has the same effect. The one other thing is if you want local variable, the variable, this I, this is a global variable. So if I say I equals 10, and then I call this, it'll change my I. So that's exactly opposite of what happens in Python. But still, you're not in too much trouble because you can declare a variable to be local. So I'll go back to this definition. I can say local of I, and now that I will be local. So if I say I equals 10, and my I is 10, and then I call this function, my I will still be 10. So it's exactly the opposite convention. The default is global, and then it's local. If you declare it explicitly to be so. And the reason is because this was added later in Perry, and it would have broken all code that anybody wrote if they made the default to be local, because people often assume that the variables are global. And you can look at Perry programs, and they typically are they typically do, at the beginning, they define a bunch of global variables, and they define a bunch of things that change the global state of the interpreter, for example, the real precision, lots of biggie, the default precision for power series, a bunch of stuff, and then they do their work. So if you have two Perry programs for different things written by different people, it's very hard to use them both at the same time in one Perry session. Unfortunately, it doesn't really integrate different code together well at all. And in fact, there's no distribution of Perry code that you can get. Perry's, almost all the code that comes with Perry is written in C, and it doesn't include any sort of extra user code written in Perry. In fact, this interpreter that I'm using was initially apparently written only for the purposes of testing out the C library, the Perry C library. Just that's the interpreter is what people usually use. Wow, okay, so any questions? I think I've told you about the three major number theory systems. Okay, all right, so now we're almost running out of time, unfortunately. So let me tell you a little bit about this document. Basically, I'm trying to finish this paper in the next week and a half. And it is in fact kind of the state of the art in trying to answer a question that was asked by one of you, I think. Did you ask?
Yeah.
You asked, well, look essentially at the first, you know, sentence, or first paragraph of this. And it says the following: suppose you are given an algebraic curve C defined over the rational number field. And let's say it's a zero locus of a single polynomial and two variables. And suppose it has at least one rational solution. How likely is it that it has infinitely many? So that's a pretty natural question to ask. What are the odds? Of course, you have to think about how to order the polynomials, how to divide them up. And you can divide up into genus 0, 1, and greater than or equal to, or sorry, greater than 1, as I did 1 week ago. Genus 0, if you have one rational point, as you saw in your first homework assignment, you get infinitely many. Genus 0 is basically a circle or an ellipse or a straight line. Genus 1, that's very subtle. You can have either infinitely many or finitely many, as we saw over and over again. That's the elliptic curve case. And genus greater than 1, you always have finitely many. That's Mordell's theorem. It's a theorem. So this paper is about trying to understand the situation for genus 1. And an important thing to dispense with or to think about, and it doesn't turn out to really be that important, but initially it is important to be clear about. How do you order genus 1 curves with a rational point? That is, how do you order elliptic curves? So one way is to sort them like they're sorted in Cremona's tables. So when I say Cremona's tables, does that not have any meaning to anyone? Is that meaningless? Is it meaningless to you? Anyone else? Cremona's tables. Well, I'll just show you what they are. They're a systematic listing of elliptic curves. And here they are. So Cremona's tables, behold. More precisely, it's a table of all elliptic curves up to conductor 120,000. Compressed, that's annoying. So let's see. Let me show you what one of the tables. So it's a list of elliptic curves and these numbers that are used to define the elliptic curve, the A invariants. So the number on the left is the conductor of the curve. I'll define the conductor for you, I think. So the conductor is an integer. It's divisible by the primes of bad reduction for the elliptic curve. That is, the primes for which, when you reduce the elliptic curve, you get a singular model, a singular equation. But you have to be careful, because that wouldn't be well defined as I just gave it. You have to consider all possible equations for your elliptic curve. And a prime divides the conductor no matter what model you choose, when you reduce the curve, you get a singular curve. There's no way to get around it. No matter how you reduce the curve, you get a singular curve. It's a theorem that there's always some prime that divides the conductor of a curve. You can't write down an elliptic curve over Q such that no matter what prime you choose, it has good reduction. That's not true over number fields, though. You can write down elliptic curves over various number fields that have everywhere good reduction. At every single prime, when you reduce, there's some model so that it has good reduction. But over the rational numbers, there isn't one. There's a generalization of this to abelian varieties, I think, due to, I forget, but maybe Fontaine, I think, for this. He wrote a paper called "There's No Abelian Variety Over Z," which means that there's no way to define an abelian variety, so there are no primes of bad reduction over the rational numbers. In any case, these are ordered by the conductor, and I told you a little bit about the conductor. It's an integer divisible exactly by the primes of bad reduction. Then the other information in an integer, in a positive integer, is the powers of the primes. So for p greater than or equal to 5, here's the recipe. You either have p divides the conductor, but p squared doesn't. This is one possibility. Or you have the other possibility, is that p squared does divide the conductor, but p cubed doesn't. So if p is greater than or equal to 5, then
and P divides the conductor of the curve, then you're in one of the following two cases. This is the case that when you look at the reduction of the curve modulo P, it looks like that. And this is the case when the reduction looks like this, which you can characterize algebraically. And that defines the conductor except at the primes 2 and 3. And the definition there is more complicated. Yes?
So is there only 5, I mean, or is there only...
Yes, the answer is yes, up to equivalence. I assume the question was, are there only finite many of each conductor?
Oh, that's a good question, too. So it's well-defined because in all but finally many of the primes have good reduction.
That's correct. Okay. That's easy to see. Take the Weierstrass equation, consider its discriminant, minus 16 Fourier cubed plus 27b squared, and that's an integer, and any prime that doesn't divide that integer will be a prime of good reduction, because the equation we chose already has, you know, distinct roots of good reduction. Okay? Yeah, so it's only divisible by a finite number of primes. So each elliptic curve over Q has a conductor n, and a way to list the elliptic curves, because there are only finitely many of each conductor, is order them by their conductors. Sometimes you have more than one curve of a given conductor. In fact, on this slide, there are 3 curves of conductor 11, 7, or 6 curves of conductor 14, and it looks like, I don't know how many, 8 curves of conductor 15, and so on. So you can have quite a number of curves of a given conductor. I've seen examples of over 1,000 curves of a given conductor, 10,000 curves of a given conductor. So you can have a lot of curves of a given conductor, but they're only finitely many of each conductor. And within the conductor, you can order, and it doesn't really make much of a difference for the sort of questions that are asked in this paper. So, so this paper is about the following question, and I'll jump very much to the point. You take elliptic curves, you extend this table really, really, really far, but when I say really far, I mean over 100 million curves. So maybe make this table so that it has 150 million curves in it. Now, that's not realistic to ever do in our lifetime using these methods, but if you allow yourself to maybe miss a few curves that probably have no effect at all on the answer, then you can do it. And in fact, we've done it. And you can look at the results.
So before you change pages,
please.
I'm just trying to understand
yes.
the numbering here. So uh-huh. I presume the first 6 numbers are the same as when you were inputting them in pre?
Yeah, 5 numbers, yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
What are the 2 outside the brackets?
The rank and the order of the torsion subgroup.
Okay.
So if we go to the curve of conductor 37, that's our favorite curve of rank 1. Right here, this first one, conductor 37. Notice there's a 1 here. That's the first curve of rank 1. If you go to 389, you'll find the first curve of rank 2. But we need short time, so I really want to get to my punchline. 389, 81. Oops. Go around again. Yeah, see, it has rank 2. So that's what that number is. So the other table, this is a massive table of elliptic curves. It takes several gigabytes to store, and it has a large number of elliptic curves of conductor up to 10 to the 8th. And this was made by myself and Mark Watkins. Mark Watkins is visiting next week and will be giving 2 talks on Thursday. Which the first one is in the new faculty seminar. This is new faculty for 1 week. And then, but he'll give a very nice introductory talk about L functions and how you compute them. So here's this table. And it's very similar to the other one, but just a more compact and more informative notation in some ways, and very confusing in other ways. But in any case, this is a massive table of curves. So what you do is you look at these, and then you make a graph of the average rank as a function of the conductor, and you see whether it turns out to be about a half. And it doesn't. For this data, it turns out to be much, much larger than a half, as you will see when you look through the notes. And the really bizarre thing is that you find a huge number of curves of rank 2. That's really what's different. When you look at all the curves in here, you find that about a little over 16% of them have rank 2. So instead of, well, the conjecture that everyone makes, still even with this data, is that 50% of curves have rank 0 and 50% of curves have rank 1, if you order this way. And it turns out, though, if you look, say, on page 9 and look at these graphs, it's a huge number of rank 2.
doesn't it all fit? The data doesn't all appear to fit with the conjectures. What really seems to be happening, though, is that you just have to look at a massive number of curves for the sort of real picture to emerge. I think the idea is that you have something like roughly x to the 3/4, some constant times x to the 3/4 curves have rank 2. And the total number of curves is something like x to the, the last thing I'm going to say, x to the 19 over 24, something like that. And this proportion for small values of x looks pretty big, but it goes to 0 as x goes to infinity. Okay, so now I've done it. But I encourage you to look through this and let me know if you have any comments. Our plan is to publish this in the bulletins as a survey paper. We're going to finish it, but this is just a preliminary version. But I think the bulletins, the background assumption on the reader is something like what you have. So maybe probably less than what you have. So if you want to give me any comments on this and look at it, we can discuss it at the beginning of class next time. But it's really a strange state of affairs. There's this conjecture that says the data should look one way, but when you actually look at the data, there's massive numbers of curves of rank 2.
And you're almost getting typos and corrections.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm sure there are many typos, but please. Or just things that don't make sense given the ordering of the presentation. Words that aren't defined that you think should be defined. Anything, any comments you want to make would be appreciated by all of us. So it's a paper by Mark and I and Barry Mazur and this guy from Kazakhstan who was a freshman at Harvard and helped me with computing a lot of these tables. But he got exiled back to Kazakhstan because he didn't get good enough grades in his other classes. He was too busy. He was a really, really, really smart guy. Gold medal and MW. And if you like don't get a good enough writing grade or something, you get exiled. Yeah. So anyways. Okay, so I'll see you on Monday. And also there's an Everett Hosgreen number 3 seminar talk you might want to go to tomorrow. On genus 2 curves. Yes,
did you check them out today?
Tomorrow at 2 to 3. Everett House talk.
Oh, yeah. I teach during that time, which is unfortunately the exact time of the number 2 seminar. But it's next term, I'll figure it out.
Yeah, or I'm going to never do the same.
Is this on today?
Yes.
What is there a visual indication that it's on?
No. It's very stealthy.